listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Friday, and normally on Friday, we start our first hour with Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls for the entire hour. Bernie has a family commitment today, so this is, I think seriously, it's probably only the fourth or fifth time in 8 years we've been doing this every Sunday that Bernie has missed a Friday. But he sends along his regards to everybody and apologies for not being able to be with us. It is the summer, too, so everybody gets a summer vacation, right? Well, maybe not Bernie. I don't know. I have a feeling he'll figure out a way to turn it into work. Meanwhile, Jeff Cohen is with us. Not to put you in a kind of second to Senator Sanders ain't bad, but
yeah,
you would have been with us in any other hour any way. But Jeff Cohen is the founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. He's the author of Cable News Confidential: My Misadventures in Corporate Media, and also relatively famous as the guy who was the producer of Phil Donahue's show back in the day when it was the number one show on MSNBC. And in 2003, because Phil Donahue was questioning more, he was asking questions about the Iraq War. Boing, off you went. So, Jeff, welcome.
It's nice to be with you. It's very unusual for a channel to terminate its most watched program, but MSNBC has done it not just once, twice.
What was the second time?
Oberman.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, Oberman's not easy to get along with, but they were causing problems for Oberman. He left.
Yeah.
Someone else who was getting good ratings on MSNBC later was Cenk Uygur, you know, from Young Turks.
Yeah.
And I think he was too critical of both parties. He wasn't playing, you know, wasn't doing blue team over red team.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's very unusual that a channel terminates its top-watched program, and when it does, it's usually pure political censorship, which is what it was when MSNBC terminated Donahue 3 weeks before the invasion of Iraq.
Well, let's talk about the state of media in the United States and about FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. FAIR.org is the website. And the media has, in our lifetime, we're not all farts here. In our lifetime, we've seen some really dramatic changes in media since the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. You want to give us an overview?
Profound changes. While there are more outlets, there's more television channels because of cable. A few companies have taken inordinate power over the media. In the 1970s, there were a lot of cities that had two or three newspapers. It's gone. We do have now hundreds of cable channels, but we have five companies that own most of them. So what we've seen over the decades is a couple trends. One is the media have been concentrated into fewer and fewer hands. Bigger and bigger corporations, but fewer of them taking over. And the second is, in the mainstream media, the Washington Press Corps, we've got this development of stars, where the people that are the biggest hosts, the top editors, are very, very cozy with the political and corporate elite. Mm. And one person that personifies it is Bob Woodward. Mm. When he was a young reporter, he unraveled a conspiracy that brought down President Nixon. Last 10 or 12 years, he's just very cozy with presidents. He doesn't care whether they're Democrats or Republicans. So we've seen this trend where the media have become, the big media, the mainstream media, cozier and cozier with power. I include, by the way, in corporate mainstream media, NPR and PBS,
right,
which are cozier and cozier with power. And I was in MSNBC during the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, which I think is a good case study in the decline of mainstream media. There was locking out of dissenting voices. People like Phil Donahue were terminated because they were just asking questions. There were mass demonstrations in the streets. Those people didn't get into the studio to pose their issues. It was like a unison. You know, it was like chant. It was like a drum beat. And if you weren't in that drum beat for war, you didn't get on the air. And that was the case not just at Fox News or MSNBC or CNN or the other networks, the front page of the New York Times, the editorial pages of the Washington Post, propelled us. It's a great case study of the decline.
Right.
And another case study is the way they've covered Snowden, the whistleblower, the NSA whistleblower. In mainstream media, the big issue, how do we get him? We, you know, we're supposed to have an independent press. How do we get him? And very little coverage of what does the surveillance state mean? How are we being surveilled? Who's profiting from it? Instead of the big questions that the American people need answered, which they get from shows like yours or Amy Goodman, in the mainstream media, there's been this obsession on Snowden and whether we capture him and how much damage has he caused.
Right.
It's been a slow decline.
Yeah, there's this constant effort to personalize everything and everybody and then you go after them with ad hominems. I was surprised. I haven't been a guest on a right wing talk show host in a long time on a right wing talk show in a long time, and one of these guys down in Texas invited me on his show a couple days ago, and you know, 8:30 in the morning, and started attacking me personally, you know, which I thought was really, really weird. It's like I debate conservatives every day. I mean, we've got two debates coming up today. I mean, Neil McCabe is going to be with us and Hayes Brown, and we're going to be talking about, you know, does the media have a double standard on racism, and should 17-year-olds be able to buy guns? And I've never, you know, in 10 years of doing this show, I don't think I've ever called somebody an idiot or questioned their parentage or their education or anything. I mean, you don't have to if you're going to talk about the... But and so the Snowden thing, I think, is a dimension of that. Let you know, hyper personalization of everything, and it's also the star syndrome. One of the questions pardon my going off on a rant here. It's what I do for a living. One of the questions that I had about this is that you mentioned NPR. In the corporate media, when people hit the point where they've got a major show on corporate media, they're pulling down millions of dollars in annual income for that individual. That's, to the best of my knowledge, not the case on NPR,
I think the people at the top, the people that have been on the air there for some decades, are doing pretty well.
Uh-huh.
It's nothing close to what you can get in mainstream television news,
right,
but they're doing pretty well.
So, so are they? I mean, I can see somebody who's got a $5 million a year salary wanting to protect
right.
that by being nice to John McCain and not wanting him to refuse to show up.
I think NPR has been in public TV. They've been so under the gun from right-wing pressure and paranoia for so many years that they keep getting more and more timid and conservative to prove that they're not liberal.
Right.
I mean, NPR is the master of the bipartisan consensus. I remember during the first debate about health care reform during the Clintons, where they would always put on the air a Democratic Congress member, former, and a former Republican Congress member, is Vin Weber and a guy named Downing. And they didn't tell the audience that both members, former members of Congress, were now lobbyists for the corporate healthcare industry.
Right.
And until FAIR raised the stink, and it's what they do over at FAIR, FAIR.org, NPR wouldn't even identify these two former Congress members
as lobbyists.
So I think just NPR has become, they're at the national news level, there's some great shows, but right. at the national news level, they're so wedded to the bipartisan consensus where they pretend that they're out on the 50-yard line. But if the Democratic corporate leadership, the conservative leadership of the Republicans, and the sort of corporate centrist leadership of the Democrats, if they're having a debate that's more like between the 10 and the 15-yard lines over on the right side of the field, and that's all NPR tells you is the leaders of the two parties, which they do often, then they're distorting reality.
Yeah.
So I just think they're wedded to power. They're wedded to government power. They're wedded to elite points of view. FAIR does a study every year which think tanks get quoted and which think tanks don't. It tends to be the big corporate-funded conservative and libertarian think tanks that get on the air the most.
Absolutely. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment with Jeff Cohen, FAIR.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Founder of FAIR.org, currently teaching at Ithaca College. We'll be right back. Okay. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Jeff Cohen with us, the founder of FAIR, FAIR.org, former producer for The Donahue Show, professor of independent media, founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media, and associate professor at Ithaca College, author of Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. We have our media changing right in front of us right now. Jeff, another Jeff has bought the Washington Post.
Jeff Bezos, yeah. the CEO and founder of Amazon. You're finding that the value of newspapers has gone down, and these billionaires can pick up these newspapers for a song. And
why has the value of newspapers collapsed?
Well, that's a long story, but initially, up until even into the last decade, newspapers were hugely profitable. Mm-hmm. Why? Because a few companies took them over, chained them up, started laying off journalists way before the internet was a problem. They were laying off journalists.
Right.
Newspapers, unlike other businesses, were getting 20% profit margins.
Mm-hmm.
And so newspapers were weakened in this country, worse than other countries, and because of corporate greed. And then the internet came along. And the double whammy of corporate greed and the internet taking away revenue, especially classified ad revenue that's through Craigslist and things
right.
like that, and other revenue, and taking away readers, that one-two whammy, and the price of newspapers has gone down. The Boston Globe sold, 15, 20 years ago for about $1 billion, and then what did it just sell for? It was like something like $75
million. Wow. Talk about a depreciating asset.
Yeah. But so Jeff Bezos is a guy who wants power. All of these internet companies, the best book on this is The Digital Disconnect by Robert W. McChesney, all about how a few corporations now are taking over the internet.
Yeah, we've had Bob McChesney on this program many times.
It's and
brilliant.
And one of these guys is Jeff Bezos of Amazon. I think he's worth like $28 billion. And so he spent less than 1% of his fortune to pick up the Washington Post in cash. But Bezos is a guy who, while he's liberal on social issues and supports gay marriage, he's very conservative on any economic issue that directly affects his pocketbook or the pocketbook of Amazon. So he's very conservative on education policy, very conservative on tax policy, and on the issue that I believe the mainstream media does worse on, which is the warfare state or warfare/surveillance state. Jeff Bezos, Amazon company, has just brought down a $600 million contract to provide cloud services for the CIA. They're part of the surveillance state.
So wait a minute. The company Amazon that was started by and is principally owned by Jeff Bezos, the guy who just bought the Washington Post, is a CIA contractor?
Yes.
Big time?
Big time.
And they have a big investment in the military industrial security complex getting bigger and bigger. And Washington Post is arguably the most influential newspaper in the United States when it comes to policy made here in Washington, D.C.
Yes. So, I mean, again, people were talking about, is Bezos going to wreck the proud journalistic tradition of the Washington Post? That tradition's been going downhill for a long time, with some exceptions. Dana Priest has been wonderful on some of these national security issues. She exposed the Walter Reed Hospital abuse.
Mm-hmm.
She exposed the black prisons, the secret prisons that were part of the war on terror. But, there's exceptions to the rule. But general, the Washington Post has been going downhill. The editorial page editor, Fred Hyatt, sees himself as part of that warfare state.
Mm-hmm.
They were big cheerleaders for the invasion of Iraq, editorial after editorial in the months leading up to the invasion of Iraq. So the Washington Post of today is very different than the Washington Post of Watergate or Pentagon Papers, mm-hmm. which was 40 years ago. But Bezos is now the new owner. He's part of the surveillance state. All of the owners are problematic. I mean,
of all of the newspapers around the country?
All the major media. I mean, they all have these powerful interests. There's almost not a story that you can hear reported on ABC World News Tonight or NBC Nightly News or CBS Evening News that their owner doesn't have a direct interest in. Trade policy, tax policy, union policy. Amazon is viciously anti-union.
Is this why the media never talks about how our trade policy has destroyed the middle class. It never talks about, you know, the card check. I mean, I haven't seen a mention of card check, you know, the right. ability of people to unionize with simply by saying yes, a majority, more than 50%, I'm saying yes, I'd like a union, which is, by the way, used to be how it was right. in America. I haven't seen a right. single mention of that in at least a year in the yeah. corporate media.
Coverage of union policy, labor policy, workers' rights, workers' conditions, trade policy. Those are some of their some of their worst issues in the mainstream media. If you go to fair.org, you'll see a critique, you know, almost on a monthly basis of how the mainstream media covers or doesn't cover those issues.
Yeah, and in fact, if anything, they seem to celebrate it, you know, and Scott
oh, no
Walker.
Doubt. Oh, look, I've written volumes about the New York Times coverage of free trade.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, free trade is good, free trade is good, free trade is good.
Yeah,
that
Tom
was
Friedman.
That was no, and that was literally a lead of a news story. Free
really?
Trade is good. If you hear it long enough, it will begin to sink in. That was a news story.
Wow.
And, yeah, they're a paper that is editorialized on how great sweatshops are as first, you know, first jobs for people that are struggling and that have come to the cities in developing countries. Most of the major press has celebrated these trade agreements that have been so bad for America's environment and the middle class here and, frankly, for working people overseas.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that's why I believe because it's the failure of the mainstream media that's built the independent media.
Right.
So many people turned off to mainstream media because of their failures to get the facts straight in the invasion of Iraq.
Right.
And then on some of these issues that you crusade on or campaign on, like trade, like workers' rights, like the middle class, you know, economic security, these are issues that the mainstream corporate media are out to lunch on. And I think when people do realize there's an alternative, they flock to it. In the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, where the mainstream networks, and I was working at MSNBC, were just cheerleading for that war, people were turning on to BBC.
Yeah.
You know, there weren't as many alternatives in 2002. Well, now there are. Amy Goodman's show has just grown since 2002
sure.
because of the failures of mainstream media.
Oh, yeah, that was when she started the War and Peace Report, and it just, yeah, it genuinely took off. Jeff Cohen is with us. He'll be back for another 15-minute segment. And, in fact, we have a couple of lines open. If you have a call for Jeff, give us a call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Actually, it looks like all of our radio lines are full. We've got two empty lines on our TV side. So, anyhow, Jeff and I will pick up some calls, and we'll cover some topics here. Anything goes Friday. Welcome back. 28 minutes past before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you in the place where despair is not an option. Looking at the New York Times headline, Obama offers plan meant to ease concerns on surveillance. He has acknowledged that he needs to, quote, restore public trust. Mr. Snowden, Jeff Cohen has done quite a work.
This brave whistleblower has got people debating the surveillance state. It's not because the mainstream media did anything right. It's because we have a brave whistleblower who's forced it into public consciousness. And
yeah.
It's just tremendous. At rootsaction.org that I co-founded, an online action group, we've been just campaigning to try to protect this brave young man,
yeah.
Edward Snowden.
Rootsaction.org. Okay. Let's pick up some phone calls here, and you and I
Great.
Can both riff on them. Rana, is it, in Williamstown, Vermont?
Well, that would be Rama.
Oh, Rama, the very first producer of this program.
Hey, glad to talk to you again. I'm going to talk, and you too, Mr. Cohen. I'm going to talk really quick because I want to cram 3 points into a very short time frame here.
Okay.
Point number one is let's not have a really rosy picture of what the press used to be, because all you need to do is go back to the end of the 19th century, the Hearst papers and our Spanish-American War, and you see the same kind of ginning up into a war that we had go off into our lead into our invasion of
Iraq. You are right. Yes. Bring me the pictures and I will give you the war, Mr. Hearst said to Mr. Remington, as I recall.
Something along that lines. And the other point number two is, you know, the great thing about today's media, and you guys started to get into it and actually covered it quite well, is the diversity that's available. And, Tom, just remember, you know, you and Louise with the Tom Hartman Show, you guys did it because you got smart and you put your entrepreneurial skills to work and your blood, your sweat and tears. And I remember you guys sitting there paying for your own satellite time to put your own radio show up on satellite.
Yeah, we did for the first couple of years, and you helped us out an awful lot, Rama. Just, you know, we started the show in our living room in Vermont, and Rama was our first producer and did everything from help put the shows together to answering the phones. It was an amazing time.
Oh, it was great. I mean, I had so much fun being a part of the beginning of something that's turned into a really great adventure. And the last point I want to make, you know, when you talk about this national news, the national newspapers, if you look at local newspapers and what's happening, they're actually going through quite a rebound. They've discovered that there's a great local conversation to be had, and it can't be had at the Washington Times or the New York Times or the Washington Post, excuse me, or the L.A. Times, Chicago Tribune. These local discussions happen in these small-town newspapers. And we not only talk about international affairs, but we talk about how they day-to-day affects our day-to-day living as neighbors to neighbors. So there's a lot of really great things that are going on that we can
celebrate. I'm with you. Rama, did you want Jeff to just riff on that stuff, or was there a specific question?
Yeah, I'm going to get out of it.
Yeah, okay. All right. Rama, thank you very much.
Okay,
great to hear from you, my friend.
First question, great point about the allegedly rosy media past. I would say the high point for mainstream media in our country was the early 70s. That was the time when a bunch of newspapers stood up to the Nixon administration and published the Pentagon Papers exposing that many previous presidents had lied to the American public about Vietnam. That was the era of Watergate, where two young reporters at the Washington Post unraveled a conspiracy and brought down a president. I think from the early 70s, we've been on a steady decline in the mainstream media, but that was its high point.
You know, it's interesting. You're talking the 1970s.
Yes.
The 1870s were arguably the high point for media in the 19th century, because that was Reconstruction, and the newspapers were actually supportive initially of Reconstruction.
Right.
And the 1770s, the newspapers brought about the American Revolution. Is it like seven's a magic number?
Yeah. There's been these ups and downs. I love media history. I mean, we were founded, the only country that had a free press.
Yeah.
It was our invention.
Yeah.
Tom Paine was the first independent journalist. He brought forward this incredibly radical notion that people could govern themselves, and he was a radical his whole life and a great writer. So, yeah, we've had these ups and downs. So I don't want to say that, oh, they're great old days and now everything sucks. But clearly in the mainstream media, there was a high point in the 70s, and because of corporate mergers, corporate greed, antitrust isn't enforced, we have been going downhill. The upswing in the last 10 years is the independent media, and that's largely because of the Internet, has helped everyone grow.
Yeah.
And in terms of the entrepreneurial spirit of Tom and Louise Hartman working 11-hour days, yes, that's what it requires. But they've built up this big following. And your last question, yes, at the local level, newspapers, print newspapers are still hurting. What you're seeing is a lot of refugees, journalists from the print newspapers, the big dailies, are often setting up their own online news operations that cut out the cost of printing, cut out the cost of distribution, and trying somehow to monetize it.
Well, there's a new resurgence for the old weeklies, what used to be the alternative weeklies in Vermont. It's called 7 Days. I believe they're doing very well.
Yeah.
And some of the, you know, I believe that the Montpelier newspaper is still independently owned, the Times Argus. And there's a bunch of these around the country that have not just hung on by their fingernails, but some of them are actually experiencing a renewal.
Yeah. It's a constant struggle. But in the mainstream dailies, which have produced most of the journalism in this country, still do. Most journalism that's chewed over on TV news and radio news comes from newspapers.
Right.
Same thing on the Internet. And at the local level, a lot of them are suffering, which is why state houses, city councils, school boards don't have the reporter in the audience anymore. That's a recipe for corruption.
Right.
And
for Alec and for...
No doubt. You're right. They step in, and where there's no journalist present. So it's problematic. It's, you know, everything is uneven. Development is uneven. Declines are uneven. But as I say, the growth of independent media, the importance of Pacifica Radio, the importance of independent hosts like Tom Hartman and Amy Goodman, that's the only bright spot for me in American political life, has been what's happened in the last dozen years in independent media.
Yeah. Flo in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, listening on KPTK's stream. Hi, Flo. You're on the air with me and Jeff.
I'd like to ask Mr. Cohen about, I think it's Warren Buffett buying up these small-town newspapers. Is that good for us? I mean, is he a liberal. I'd like to think he's more on the liberal side, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'll tell you this.
Mr. Cohen know about that?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting development. What you have basically, Professor McChesney says, you've got the newspapers have become, again, playthings for billionaires. And the cost of newspapers has gone down, and somehow these billionaires think that after initial losses, they're going to somehow turn it into a profit. Buffett has bought up a bunch of newspapers. My sense on these corporate executives is, like most corporate executives, media executives are liberal on social issues and conservative on the economic issues that affect their private or corporate wealth. That's the case for Jeff Bezos. He gave big money to gay marriage in the state of Washington. He also gave big money to defeat an income tax that would only have been on the top 1% in the state of Washington. Bezos, who knows?
Was it a luxury?
No, they don't even have an income tax. Yeah, it was a
1%,
and it was just going to be on the top 1%. You had to earn $200,000 as an individual or $400,000 a year as a couple, and Bezos helped defeat it. He's conservative on union policy. He's conservative on education policy, and he's part of the surveillance state with the CIA contract that Amazon has just received. So I'm assuming, from what I know of Mr. Buffett, he's certainly not a right winger. I think he's liberal on a lot of social issues. But, you know, they're not the kind of owners we need. We need independent owners. We need journalists in control. We need nonprofits where the journalists make the decisions on what news is and what news isn't.
And we need to go back to pre-82 when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and have local ownership so that the local owners of the newspapers have to face their readers every day. I mean, literally and physically.
Right. And I mean, right now we have too many monopoly-owned daily newspapers.
Yes.
And because they're now single newspaper cities, I think that's why Buffett felt he could turn it into a profit.
Yeah. We used to live in Portland, Oregon, and the biggest newspaper there is owned by a corporation in New York State. It's like, really? Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. We have 2 minutes to the break. Bob, real quick one for Jeff.
Sure. Yeah. Tom and Louise, hats and feathers to you.
Thank you.
All the work you do. We understand that 12-hour day. We are independents. We are supporters of democracy. And, Jeff, it's good to hear you on the air. Rama, right on. Those three points
Bob,
you made.
Bob, a question?
Yeah, it's just I'm just giving you kudos here.
Thank you.
And I'm saying that democracy is alive and well. It's not necessarily on the air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what we're noticing. And we'd like it to be on the air. More.
Okay, great. Bob, so how do we get democracy in the air more? Thank you, Bob.
Yeah. Well, I think the issue is people using this amazing tool, which is still free, which is the Internet. We still have net neutrality.
And
we still
have to fight for net neutrality.
Right. We have to fight to keep it, and we use the Internet to spread the word about these amazing broadcasts. Mm-hmm. You can take these segments from Tom Hartman, the Amy Goodman segments, send it to people that aren't watching now, aren't listening now. The Internet is a real tool for organizing and democracy and activism at this moment in history, and we need to use it to bolster these independent sources of news. It's an exciting time to be a journalist. That's what I teach my kids. I teach independent media and journalism department, and there's a lot of – I've got an intern who's working at Free Speech TV.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the good news is – these independent outlets, and for those of us who are news, who are privileged enough to know about them, we have to spread the word. We have to donate. The way you build democracy is building independent media. You can't have a democracy without a free, independent, and adversarial news media. It's got to be adversarial to power.
Yeah, speaking in the fourth estate, the functionally the fourth branch of government.
Yes,
holding the others accountable and holding them in check. Jeff Cohen, Jeff, I know you've got a meeting you've got to boogie out to, so we're going to take a break here. But
it's been great.
It has. And check out fair.org and
rootsaction.org, which is an online activism organization, independent.
I have to learn more about that. We got to do a program just about that. Jeff Cohen, we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Roots Action, or Roots Action, depending on what part of the country you're from, with an S, action.org. Take it back to mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, and welcome back. Jeff Cohen is off to a meeting over at Ralph Nader's place. Well, of course. What do you expect? And we're having a good time here. It's Anything Goes Friday, so we're just going to pick up your phone. We do have a debate at the top of each of the next 2 hours, but the rest of the time throughout the day, whatever you want to talk about, it's all yours. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Not much. I'm a teacher in San Francisco Unified School District, and I teach social studies is one of the subjects. And the definition of human rights, my chapter 10 says, human rights include the right to speak freely, have a fair trial, if accused of a crime, and to work. They also include the right to have food, clean water, and safe place to live. So I'm just seeing that how the Republicans are kind of against human rights because they're for fracking, including our water. They're against food stamps and feeding people, and pretty much against free speech, I think.
Well, and I would go beyond that. If you have a right to a job, that means that the government has an obligation to step in and offer you a job when capitalism fails, which is the point that Franklin Roosevelt was making in the 30s when he hired 12 million people and put America back to work. If you have a right to housing, then if the housing market has failed, if housing is not available or has become priced out of the reach of most people, that's when, again, the government has an obligation to step in. As you point out with food stamps, if you have a right to eat, to food, then if, again, capitalism has failed you, the government should be stepping in those areas. And these are things where Republicans would be quick to call you a socialist or even a communist if you suggest them. And I would submit that the vast majority of Americans, they love Franklin Roosevelt for this. They reelected him 3 times. He was the only 4-term president in the history of the United States. And frankly, they love Bernie Sanders for saying these kinds of things. I can't say that each one of those issues that I just articulated is exactly the way that Bernie would say it. I would never want to speak for him, but you get my point. And over and over and over again, Republicans instead are saying, no, those are not human rights, because once you define them as rights, then governments have an obligation, a legal obligation, to defend them. And this was the essence, Jeff, of Franklin Roosevelt's second Bill of Rights, as I'm sure you know, that he rolled out just the year before he died, was to say that let's put this right into the Constitution, or at the very least put it into law, that you have a right to a job, that you have a right to a place to live, that you have a right to an education, and so on. Well said, Jeff. Thank you very much for the call. Brilliant, brilliant. Jack in Sacramento, California. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hi, can you hear me?
I hear you just fine, yes.
Okay, well, sure, great, your show and Mike Papantonio's two best on TV, but I wanted to get your reaction on the vote to continue the NSA oversight. My Congressman, Army Baron Nancy Pelosi, supported it.
Yep.
You know, and you talk about keeping us safe, but it costs a lot of money and what keeps us from organizing. How do you feel about continuing the NSA? By the way, they took you off my serious show here. Did you folks ask to be pulled?
No, we didn't. We did not. And Jack and I, you know, we are still on Sirius Satellite Radio and XM, and we don't talk about our affiliates on the air. It's just, you know, it's not an appropriate thing. And I forgot what Jack's original question was. So, oh yeah, the NSA. Well, let's pick up another call here. Catherine in New York City. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to tell you, well, I want to ask you a question after this, but what a wonderful thing Monsanto did for me.
Mm-hmm.
I was, several years ago, maybe about 4 or 5, I was listening late at night, and our local affiliate with NPR had an ad for Monsanto. I flipped and turned them off and spoke to a friend the next day, and she told me to try WRL in New York, and I found you.
Yeah, here we are.
They're wonderful to push me your way. But the question I have for you is, you know, when Bush put out all the color-coded scare techniques?
Yeah.
I kind of feel like that's going on right now. So people would say, well, it's not so bad that they spy on us because we're saving the country and people are trying to kill us. And I think it's a lot of BS, you know?
Yeah, I don't disagree, Catherine. Thank you for the call. This is, well, it's in essence what the previous caller was asking about. And the headline in today's New York Times, Obama offers plan meant to ease concerns on surveillance. Had I been a member of Congress, I would have voted to say to the NSA, sorry, we're not going to pay for this program anymore. If you want to come to us with a program that spies on people for whom you have a warrant to spy on, however that sentence should be constructed, then we'll fund that. We do want you catching bad guys. But catching everybody, not the role of government, not the job of government. And President, and again, Ed Snowden has done a tremendous service to this republic. A tremendous service to this republic by revealing the level to which we are being spied upon and sparking this national conversation, which he said from the get-go, that was his goal, was to start a conversation. He's done it. And just the same as the Pentagon Papers with Daniel Ellsberg, you know, wake the people up. So the president had to acknowledge that he needs to, quote, restore the public trust. That's a pretty damn big acknowledgement. So Jay in Greendale Heights, Illinois, got a minute to the break. Jay, quick one. Jay? No. Tom in Tucson, Arizona, that minute's yours.
If government doubles the tax on business, would business necessarily have to increase their prices?
No. Taxes are one of many different costs that can be moved around. Income can be moved around. Companies can reduce the dividends that they're paying their stockholders. They can reduce the level of compensation to their CEOs. They can, you know, they can tighten up and operate more efficiently. If you look back at history, I mean, you know, just go back and look at federal tax rates on corporate activity back to 1900, and they've been all over the map. And you don't see sudden bursts or seizing ups of corporate activity as a consequence of tax increases. In fact, tax increases did not drive the Great Crash in 1929. If anything, it was a tax cut. Warren Harding's tax cuts in 1920 that led to the bubble that popped in 1929. So the answer is no. It might increase the costs of goods, but it wouldn't double the cost of goods, not even close. Thanks for the call, Tom. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Neil McCabe is on the line with us. Neil is a blogger and the editor of the Guns and Patriots newsletter. And you can find all of his wide variety of writings over at Neil W. McCabe, MCCABE.com. And Neil is spelled N-E-I-L. Neil, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom.
It's great having you. You're a big fan of guns.
I
like guns for target practice. I love skeet shooting, those nasty skeets. I mean, they deserve to get it, right? Target practice, but I've never shot anything that was living or wanted to, or even at anything that was living. It seems that we have a difference of opinion here on whether or not teenagers should be allowed to buy guns. How many states? First of all, is this a state matter, not a federal level matter, is it not?
Well, I think right now it's still at the state level because we, you know, obviously we're trying to bring national reciprocity for concealed carry, you know, state to state to state, but that's sort of that's stalled for a number of reasons that we probably shouldn't go into, but right now it's at the states. And the NRA is trying to speak up for the rights of teenagers to have their gun rights restored.
So how many states don't allow somebody under 21 to buy a gun, and how many states don't allow someone under 21 to own or carry a gun in situations like hunting? And then finally, how many states don't allow or target shooting? And finally, how many states don't allow someone under 21 to even possess a gun under any circumstances?
I don't have those in front of me.
Okay, I'm pretty sure that the last category is zero, right?
Yeah,
because I know in Georgia, I took my kids to a shooting range when they were like 10. One of them was 10 anyway, so they allowed that.
you know, you have states like Vermont where basically your constitution is your permit, and then you have states like New York and Illinois where it's a little bit more restrictive.
Okay. So why the campaign? What is it that you guys are trying to do?
Well, I think, you know, you can understand, Tom, that the teenage gangbangers or terrorists don't really go through legal means to get their firearms or their handguns. But there are teenagers who either want to carry for to protect themselves or their families, or they feel that their life is in danger, or for target practice and competitive things. And there's really no reason why these teenagers shouldn't be allowed to have a handgun. Certainly, if you go around any of the country roads in this country, you'll see children of all ages carrying long guns. So we certainly trust children with long guns, and a handgun is a short long gun, right?
Well, yes and no. I'm guessing that most of the states that ban gun purchases by people under 21 are doing so for the reason that you described. They're trying to keep them out of the hands of gangbangers. And but if somebody's in a gang in an inner city, and that, you know, and there is no recreational facility, and there is no employment opportunity for them, and their school sucks, and, you know, all the things that are the consequences of 32 years of Reaganomics, why would you say that as long as they're not engaging in criminal activity, they should not have the exact same right as your sweet white high school valedictorian 18-year-old to or 17-year-old to own a gun? Why? Why not?
I have no problem with gangbangers or terrorists having guns if they feel their life is in danger. If they're not using it for criminal activity, I have no issue with them.
So, really?
I'm just saying that, but you have to understand, Tom.
So you think throwing...
You have to be aware, but there are people who don't follow the laws, and they buy their guns, you know, through the black market.
Right.
And gangbangers and terrorists seem to have better access to that than the sweet whites that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, well, I was being sarcastic. Apparently you missed it. The point that I'm making, I guess, is that a gun is a piece of equipment that is designed with one purpose in mind, and that is to be a very, very efficient way to cause the end of the life of some living thing, whether it's a gun designed for hunting, whether it's a gun designed for military use, or whether it's a gun designed for self-defense or for concealed carry. They're designed to be able to kill somebody, and if you don't have the threat of being able to kill somebody, you could argue, and many gun advocates do, that it wouldn't even be an effective self-defense tool. Do we really want to say, in a country where we say that if you're under 21, you're still sufficiently, I mean, especially given what we know about neuroscience now, that the frontal brain doesn't even complete its development until around 22 or 23 years old, the part of the brain that inhibits behaviors, that do you really want to say that we're not going to let you drink because we know that you're not a fully developed adult, but we are going to let you carry around something that can kill other people?
Well, I mean, I guess the short answer is, you know, I deployed to Iraq, and there were many, there were even 17-year-olds, but there were certainly a ton of 18, 20, you know, 19-year-olds, where you were armed every day. It was a fully armed society, both inside and outside the wire. And you know, there really weren't any, there were, you know, obviously there would be incidents from time to time every year or so, but there weren't the kind of issues that you would make you worry. And I interacted with those people all the time. You know, I think that one of the things you have to watch out for is that, you know, somebody who has, you know, an 18-year-old who has a handgun because he feels his life is in danger, if he gets charged, you know, if that's illegal, he now has a gun charge on his record, and that puts him really behind the eight ball for the rest of his life when the guy just wants to defend himself or his family. You know, and if there's a 15-year-old kid on the street who feels that his life is in danger, I would want him to have the right to protect yourself. The Constitution doesn't say we have an obligation to be victims.
So you think that 15-year-olds should be able to carry around weapons of mass destruction?
Well, I think that obviously there would be parents involved in that decision.
Why?
But other than that, I really don't have an issue with it. I mean, it's, you know, in the town I grew up in, you know, people had you know, kids in my high school had guns all the time. You know, they went hunting and whatnot.
Yeah, let's make it clear. This is all what we're describing here as a worst-case scenario, or what I'm describing as a worst-case scenario, what you're describing as a best-case scenario, which is unlimited, unfettered access to guns to everybody, regardless of age, under pretty much any circumstances, including carrying them on a concealed basis, is simply the law in the state of Vermont. But it is very much not the law in other states, and that's all fine with me, by the way. I'm a big supporter of states and cities being able to come up with their own laws. But you don't want states and cities to be able to come up with their own laws about who can carry a weapon and who can't. Do I have that right? You want big government to prevent states. You want big government to prevent states from essentially doing what they consider is the best thing to protect their own people.
I guess what I'm saying is that I would always tend to be on the side of freedom, and I don't want to pre-punish crimes. And if somebody does a crime with a handgun or a long gun,
are you also on the side of democracy?
Punish them severely.
Are you also on the side of democracy, Neil? Small D democracy. Are you also on the side of democracy of what the majority of the electorate wants, the majority of the electorate gets?
Well, obviously, I'm four square behind democracy, Tom, with obviously protections for minorities.
So why do you want to take – yeah, that's a given. Why do you want to take away the freedom of individual states to decide on a democratic basis who should and who shouldn't have a gun?
Because there are certain things that, because of the 14th Amendment, the federal government has to step in because states can't always be trusted to protect those freedoms, which we saw.
So you – so this is an equal protection argument in your mind.
I've lived long enough to invoke the 14th Amendment with you. See what you've done?
Okay, yeah, indeed. Neil McCabe, neilwmccabe.com. Hang on. Neil.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Neil, N-E-I-L-W McCabe, M-C-C-A-B-E.com. Neil, thanks for dropping by today.
Great to be with you, Tom. Take care.
Good talking with you. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I just went over to rootsaction.org, the site that Jeff Cohen, our earlier guest, co-founded from the previous hour. And they've got a bunch of cool things. A petition to ban weaponized drones from the world. A petition to nominate Bradley Manning for the Nobel Peace Prize. That's pretty cool. There's Mr. President, hands off Edward Snowden. The budget debate needs an intervention. It's unacceptable that President Obama is keeping a reporter in prison in Yemen. Actually, that guy got freed ultimately, so that's pretty good news. So, Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle, you got a report on what's going on out there, Mark?
Hey, I was just enjoying that segment with Jeff Cohen. I'd love to hear him talk more again about media democracy.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Very smart man.
Yeah. I really appreciate that kind of discussion because, you know, I'm pretty committed to journalism these days, and I find myself going to the Reporters Without Borders website and finding out that on their World Press Freedom Index, the United States is now listed as 32nd in the world, which means, of course, that there are 31 other countries where at least this group thinks that there's more press freedom, more ability for journalists to do their job, and more access to vital information about society than is happening here. Okay. And I need to point out, of course, that this is they're not accusing the United States of being a state-run media like a lot of other countries. What they're saying is that the corporate control of the airwaves has made it very difficult for even alternative media and new journalism to kind of get the word out to the rest of the population.
Yep.
And
this is the gift that Ronald Reagan gave us by, in 1982, ending the Sherman, stopping enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act so that these giant monopolies could form. And then in 1987, ending the enforcement by the FCC of their Fairness Doctrine, which was actually formally taken off the books this year by President Obama, but it had not been enforced since 1987, so what the heck? And the Fairness Doctrine said if you are going to broadcast over the public airwaves, and frankly, I would be one who would argue it should extend to, you know, from outer space or over the cable systems that go through our public rights of way, that if you're going to use the public airwaves, then the fee for that, as it were, is that you must at least program in the public interest, which means giving people real news rather than infotainment.
Plus, you had a Federal Communications Commission that, except for the two Democrats, Edelstein and Cox, were totally for more corporate media ownership consolidation.
Yeah.
And I testified before the FCC hearings on that issue and brought up two suppressed reports that the FCC itself had commissioned. One of the gentleman's names was Professor Janich, and he claimed that his studies on the effects of corporate media consolidation had been suppressed by the FCC. And when I asked the commissioners to respond to their own funded studies, they claimed that they didn't know that they existed. So what the studies showed was that corporate ownership of the media and this consolidation of corporate ownership results in less local coverage, less media ownership for minority and female portions of the community. Right. So, you know, some really negative forces have taken over, and thank God you're on the air, and thank God Amy Goodman's on the air, and thank God we have Free Speech TV and Free Speech Radio on Pacifica to help keep the word out. But in reality, as a journalist, I have to accept the fact that I'm living in a country where, oh, and by the way, the Reporters Without Borders cited two different factors in the drop that the United States has experienced on their World Press Freedom Index over the last few years. And that has to do with, one, the arrests and harassment of a lot of reporters and journalists at the Occupy Wall Street protests.
Yep.
And then, two, this latest story about the surveillance of Associated Press reporters.
Yeah.
So those are issues that definitely come into play there.
So, Mark, it's time for us to start the chant. We get out in front of the TV cameras, we hold our signs up, and we proudly chant, "We're number 32! We're number 32! It's pretty grim, isn't it? Mark, thank you for the call. Excellent points all that you made, and thank you for sharing that with our listeners and our viewers. Terry, in West Bend, Wisconsin, you wanted to share with us about Ben Anderson's "This Is What Winning Looks Like"? Terry?
Hello?
Terry, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hello, Tom? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes, sir. Last week I had the honor, privilege, joy of attending the 9th annual Traverse City Film Festival that was begun by Michael Moore about 9 years ago. And one of the documentaries I saw was called "This Is What Winning Looks Like" by Ben Anderson. He's a British journalist, et cetera. It covered current situation in Afghanistan with their police and army and the behaviors as our army and Marines try to teach them and get them independent. And from watching it, I got the idea that we're saving face there. We want to withdraw, so we're going to put up with anything going on. Have you had a chance? It's on YouTube to also, "This Is What Winning Looks Like," so everybody can see it. It takes about 90 minutes. Have you had any opportunity to either see it or know anything about the situation?
I have not seen it, but I'm going to make a note to look at it this weekend.
Oh, it's amazing. And he has written the book. I forget the title. I did get it, and I have to read it.
In snapshot, we have about 40 seconds, what does winning look like?
We're not, or they are not. In fact, there was one Marine who was about the only one who spoke up and said it as it is. And he was, it sounds like he was chastised.
Yeah.
When his term was up, they showed the dignitaries.
Wait a minute! I have seen that documentary. I know what you're talking about. Yes, I have. And you're right, it's brilliant. It is absolutely brilliant. Terry, thank you for calling and sharing that with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I remember the Marine getting knocked around. Anyhow, it's Anything Goes Friday on Anything Goes Summer. More of your calls, the news of the day, and my take on it right after this. Welcome back to Talk Media for the Sane Among Us. Tom Hartman here with you, and Bridget in Newport, Oregon. Hey, Bridget, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I really appreciate all the talking that you and many others have done about the importance of media consolidation and fighting that. One of the things I never hear you mention is community radio.
Oh, my. We're on community radio all over the country. We're on low-power FM stations in a number of cities, Asheville, North Carolina, Seattle. We're on medium and high-powered community radio stations. We're on the biggest community radio station, live on the biggest community radio station, I think, in the world, maybe in the United States, KPFK in Los Angeles, the Pacifica affiliate. So,
yes,
yeah, I'm a big fan of community radio.
No, I know you are. But what I the talk that I hear when people... And not you so much, but people who are on the talk that I hear is always, we need to go to the internet, and that's where the real source, where the real power is going to be.
Yeah.
And I, the reason that this comes up for me is because a number of us in my community got really tired of the lack of any kind of real community media and progressive media, and. So in the 2007 window that the FCC opened for full-power FM licenses in the NCE band, non-commercial educational band, we did an application, and we have a construction permit, and we're in the process of building a station.
How cool is that? That's wonderful.
It's incredibly cool, and part of the problem is finding the funding to actually get it on the air and get the things going that we want to do. We're going to make it. We're going to make our CP, but it's been a struggle. It will be a struggle to stay on the air. And what I am wanting people to understand is that there are these community stations out there that are really working to do the kind of radio that you're talking about, and they need support.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, for years when I was doing commercial radio and before we had developed the ability here to do non-commercial radio, and I'll explain that in just a second, but for years before that, anytime, I mean, I used to routinely, when we were, I guess, quote, competing, I never thought of it as competition, but we were carried on KTLK in Los Angeles, and I'd go on KPFK and do their fund drives. And the same thing with the San Francisco station, the same thing with Cable in Portland, Oregon. For years I did their fund drives. And I'm totally supportive of community radio. And what we did, and I wish more progressive shows would do this. I know that I know of one right now that is in the process of doing this and another that has already done it. But most of the progressive shows are just on commercial radio. And what we do is we have literally two automation systems. We're producing two identical and simultaneous radio shows. You know, I'm speaking right now on both of them. In other words, they sound pretty much identical, except that one has commercial breaks that run commercials for our commercial stations. God bless them. And they actually provide the vast majority of the support for our show, keep us on the air. So thank you so much to our commercial stations. And the other that generates a stream for our non-commercial stations, where during the commercial times of the commercial stations, there's non-commercial compliant content, you know, Jim Hightower content and labor radio news and things like that, that work for them. So that we've, you know, and then third, we're also live on Free Speech TV, and then we also have, you know, an internet stream. In fact, Talkers Magazine just came out with their Frontier 50, they call it, of the top shows that are watched on the internet. And Glenn Beck is number one, of course, because he moved his huge Fox audience entirely to the internet. But we're number seven, and we're on all these other platforms as well. So it's a formula that, and I'm saying that not to brag, but just to encourage other people to do it. And also, you know, when the time comes, Bridget, that you all are on the air, if our show's on your station, or even if our show isn't, and you'd like me to voice liners or promos or requests, you know, when you're doing your fund drives, let us know. Drop us a note, because we do that. We do that. There's no cost. We usually turn them around in 24 hours. We do the same thing for our commercial stations. I voice commercials for their advertisers, at least the ones that I, you know, personally would consider buying their products. And you know, liners, it's what you do in this business.
Who had better believe you will hear from us?
Good, good. And do you have a website, Bridget, that you want to promote so that people in the Oregon area who are interested in helping around Newport can pitch in?
actually the whole Oregon Central Coast, kyaq.org.
Okay.
We're trying really hard to raise money to get on the air. We're going to launch a Kickstarter campaign shortly. RCP, our construction permit, expires January 4th of next year. So we're in the last bit of trying to get on the air.
You got a lot of work to do. And let me note, for people...
A whole lot of it's been done, and the fortunate thing is that we have a lot of really competent people and radio people working. And what I would love from you is to encourage to do what you just did, to encourage other progressive hosts and people out there to do the kind of work that you're doing. I mean, we're affiliating with Pacifica, so we will have the option of carrying you and carrying Democracy Now. I know the kind of work that you're doing across all platforms. I would love to see other people do it, especially even people like Mike Papantonio, who are so strong about getting into independent media.
Well, Pap now has a weekend TV show, Ring of Fire TV, that's on Free Speech TV. I would encourage you to contact them. I can't speak for any of those folks, and we don't like get together every month and hatch schemes to take over the world. I mostly run into my colleagues, you know, when we all do a speaking event together that typically a radio station promotes. So I don't, you know, I see them occasionally, almost every year at our progressive commercial station, the Minnesota's Progressive Voice up in Minneapolis. That was the last time a bunch of us got together, and I was there with, well, I don't want to get into names, but, I think the one of the things that holds people back is that there's no revenue model for non-commercial radio. There's no way to make money. So for us, it's an expense. It's not it cuts into our revenue from commercial radio. But I'm of the opinion that if you have a good message and you are providing a good product, and you believe in your cause, that it's not all just about making money. You know, it's like, you know, try to get the message out there. So that's why we do it. But so I would encourage you to contact my colleagues, use my name. And if they want to know how to do it, tell them to give us a call, because we are pleased to mentor anybody through that process. Okay, Bridget?
It's really hard to find places to contact people that the email might actually get through. Can you, off the air, give me...
I can't. I just can't. That's just something that, you know, it would be a violation of protocol, as it were. But I can tell you that every one of those all of the shows... You may not be able to get the personal email of the host of the show, but you can probably fairly easily get the email of the webmaster or of the producer, and those people are, you know, they're interacting with the host every single day. So the message will get it passed along. Okay?
Tom, thank you so much for what you do and for the support, and you will hear from us when we're...
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Bridget, and thanks for the call. Sherry in Brocksville, Alabama. Hey, Sherry, what's up?
Hi, Tom. This is Siri. I just saw on the news that Obama's going to try to put in Sumner to the Federal Reserve.
You mean Larry Summers?
Yeah. It was just now on the news.
Really?
And I said, yeah, Larry Summers and another lady I named Think Fleming. I might have called it wrong, but...
The woman by the name of Yellen, I believe, is the one who...
Yellen. Isn't she the billionaire out of Chicago?
I don't know if she's... No, you're thinking of Penny Pritzker. Yellen is the woman who is the number two person at the Fed. She's relatively progressive. I think she would make a great chairperson for the Fed.
Oh, then that's why she gets it.
And if Lawrence Summers gets that job, I am going to faint dead away. I would be astounded if he gets that job. President Obama did defend him recently in a press conference, but I think that was more because, you know, he just wanted to defend a guy who was formerly one of his economic advisors. I don't think that I don't think that he was trying to send a message that, and I'm looking at the New York Times, which, you know, if anything like that was coming out, it would be on the front page. What was the news source you got that from, Sherry?
Yeah, just on MSNBC. They just announced it, and he said either one would be great.
Oh, either one. Okay, so it was somebody offering their opinion. Yeah, either one would not be great. Lawrence Summers is a toad, and I usually don't engage in ad hominems and pick on people personally, but You know, let me retract that and simply say Lawrence Summers on everything economic in every single case has always been wrong. His advice to the president was always wrong. His opinions on privatization were wrong. Lawrence Summers is just consistently, he's the last person you want as chairman of the Fed. And, you know, if you don't believe me, look at people like Paul Krugman, who are, I believe Paul Krugman is offering a similar opinion. So, Sherry, thanks for the heads up. But, you know, it's not a done deal. It is definitely not a done deal. And I am not, I can't speak for the White House, certainly. But I would be astounded if somebody with such a bad reputation as Lawrence Summers was appointed to chair the Fed by President Obama, when the number two person at the Fed, who really knows what she's doing, is sitting right there ready and waiting to go.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And TomHartman.com, you can drop into our free live chat room as well, which is more fun than a barrel full of monkeys. Check in with the Talk Radio News Service and find out what's going on in the world. Brought to you, of course, by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Victoria Jones at the White House. Victoria,
I am at the White House. Yes.
Oh my! You're in the luxury Talk Radio News suite in the basement, right underneath the Oval Office.
The suite.
Yes.
Yes.
The AKA the closet. Yes.
Yes, AKA the closet. Yes. Fresh from the Obama press conference, I am.
Okay, and what happened at that press conference? I saw it on TV, but I was on the air. I couldn't listen to it.
Well, President Obama unveiled new measures that he says will increase transparency and build public trust in the government surveillance programs.
Really?
Yep.
But he's not going to close them down?
Nope.
So it's a PR campaign.
Well, there are one or two among them that may make a difference. They were a combo platter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me about it.
He said that given the history of abuse by governments, it's right to ask questions about surveillance, particularly as technology is reshaping every aspect of our lives. And he said he plans to overhaul Section 215 of the Patriot Act that governs the collection of so-called metadata, the phone records program, the Verizon program that we all know about that's scooping up the calls.
Now, am I incorrect in believing that in order to overhaul Section 215 of the Patriot Act, it has to pass through the House of Representatives and the Senate before it gets to the president for his signature?
Well, that's what's interesting about a lot of these things.
So he's proposing things that are going to have to be done by Congress.
Some of these things would have to be done by Congress.
Okay. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just, you know, it makes it a little, given the...
More difficult, given Congress.
Yeah.
Right. He's also going to pursue with Congress a reform of the secretive Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court.
Okay.
Now, as you know, the way it works now, it's completely one-sided. Government makes its case, and there's a big... Nobody sitting in the other chair.
That's right. And all those people on that court, every single one of them is appointed by one man, Chief Justice John Roberts.
That's right. Exactly. Well, what he's proposing would be to have a civil liberties representative or a somebody weigh in on the court's deliberations to ensure an adversarial voice is heard.
One out of what, 12?
Well, to have an adversarial process. So you have your government lawyer, you have somebody else.
Oh, I see.
So okay. You'd have an adversarial process.
Yeah, I think that's a marvelous idea. Can he do that administratively, or does
it has to be worked out with Congress, apparently.
Okay. All right.
He also wants to provide more details about the NSA programs to try to restore public trust damaged by the Snowden disclosures. Mm-hmm. He also wants to form a high-level group of outside experts to review the surveillance effort. They're also going to create a website that we can go to learn more about the programs, which my opinion now is going to tell us nothing because everything's classified.
So, it's sort of in the spirit of healthcare.gov, which actually does tell you everything you need to know about Obamacare, they would have a website called WeSpyingOnYou.gov,
exactly.
And you go there, and there's a big black bar across the middle that says classified, right?
Yes, and there'll be a guy with one of those blindfold things across his, you know, faces, looking like a spy with a big
Yeah, there you go. With a sensor,
like Sherlock Holmes.
A sensor to cross his mouth and
exactly.
Yeah.
And then he took questions on a number of these questions. He also said, "I don't think Mr. Snowden is a patriot." He also said this, which was very interesting, and I think you'll pick up on this. "I called for a thorough review of our surveillance programs, operations before Mr. Snowden made those leaks. My preference, and I think the American people's preference, would have been for a lawful, orderly examination of these laws, a thoughtful, fact-based debate that would then lead us to a better place."
But
how would the American people have known about them?
Oh, I see. And why wasn't he telling Ron Wyden about that?
Exactly.
Okay.
So another issue that came up at the press conference was Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
He made some interesting points about the rollout and about the government shutdown, and he had a couple of interesting lines that if the Democrats took them up with regard to the shutdown would probably do them quite well. He said, "I think the really interesting question is why it is that my friends in the other party have made the idea of preventing these people from getting health care their holy grail, their number one priority. Their unifying principle is making sure 30 million people don't have health care." He said, "The idea that we're going to shut down the government unless we can prevent 30 million people from getting health care is a bad idea."
Wow. Talk about defining the frame. Good on you, President Obama.
I thought it was well framed.
Yes.
And really turned it around.
Yeah, worthy of Frank Luntz.
Yeah, nicely done. Also on Obamacare news, there was quite a lot of Obamacare news today, actually. Senate Majority Harry Reid today said it's obvious that some Republicans are trying to do everything they can to ensure that President Obama's legislative priorities fail. And he said, "I hope that's based on substance and not the fact that he's an African American."
What?
Yes, he said that.
Who said this?
Harry Reid.
What did I miss here? I
Well, he was talking about Obamacare.
Right. And oh, and he was saying he was hoping that the
affiliate.
I see. So he was saying that he hopes that the people who are opposing this president are doing so because they don't like his policies, not because they don't like his race.
Yes.
Well, I congratulate Harry Reid on saying that, because you and I both know that there are a lot of people who are opposing President Obama because of his race.
Just people don't usually say it.
Yes. Yeah. I'm impressed that, you know, a powerful white guy came out and said that, because there's a lot of people in the African-American community who know that.
There. He also said that the filibuster fight is not over.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yes, he did. He said it's been abused. If it continues to be abused, I'm confident the rules will be changed.
Good on Harry Reid.
Yeah, wow. He was pretty feisty today.
Wow, they upped his testosterone.
Yeah.
It's remarkable.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll have to, you know, if you're in Nevada or if you're not, you might want to call Harry Reid's office and say, well said. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always nice seeing you. Thank you. We will be back. Hayes Brown with thinkprogress.org is going to be with us to talk about the media double standard on racism.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, of course. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. And Hayes Brown is on the line with us. He's a blogger and writer over at the Center for American Progress's thinkprogress.org blog. Specializes in national security issues. Hayes, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Great to have you with us. Is there a media double standard on racism? You were writing about, I believe you were writing about Huckabee's rant about Muslims as uncorked animals, and you know.
I was, in fact.
Pardon?
I said I was, in fact.
You were, in fact. Okay, and you can't draw an absolute parallel between people being Muslim and being people of color, although I think probably the vast majority of them are. Do you think that is, you know, Mike Huckabee used to be a preacher, a Christian preacher. Where do we draw these lines, and or where do you think Huckabee is, and what do you think is really going on here?
I think that a large part of the problem is that Americans, for the most part, don't know how to talk about religion. Even religious people like Huckabee, they don't know how to discuss it, is the thing. When someone says that, for example, the perpetrators of Benghazi, let's say, were likely Muslim, that is true, and that they were Muslim extremists is also true, and that is a factor to consider when analyzing the situation. But to do things like Huckabee does and did and say that all Muslims, when they leave, their Friday prayer, come out like, quote, uncorked animals, that is, shows that you don't know how to discuss these things in a cogent manner, and that hurts all of us.
Well, it also shows that he's never been to a college football game. I mean, you know, white people leave things in like uncorked animals. If you want to use that metaphor, I think it's a pretty ugly metaphor. But and in fact, in this context, there is a subtext to that metaphor that resonates for the white supremacists among us, for the people who hang out in the hard right message boards. And you know, I've been talking on the air for a couple of days about how one of my articles got picked up by one of these websites, and the way I knew it was in the middle of the day on Sunday, all of a sudden I get like five or six emails calling me an N-word lover, which is their way of saying somebody who supports our president. And, you know, a couple of death threats and, you know, just all this kind of total ad hominem, et cetera, et cetera. And I was trying to figure out what the heck happened. And Louise says, oh, I'll bet you're on, you know, and she went off to the website. And sure enough, they had picked up my article. And so anyhow, you want to riff on that a bit?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it does help to give a lesser than quality to people who are different than you. It's hard to look at someone as a person and hate them, but if they're not a person, then it makes it much easier to do so. And that's the sort of thing that comes about when you use language like uncorked animals, for example. It just makes it easier. I mean, and the internet, it doesn't, the anonymity of the internet helps that. Helps you not really connect with the idea that someone is on the other end. And so that's a problem as well that you see us when it comes to people spewing this sort of hatred, really.
Right. In other words, before a person can, a non-sociopathic person, can easily hate people people who they don't know, they have to first objectify them. They have to turn them into something other than, in their own mind, something other than people. And then once they've done that, it's really easy for things to slip out like, oh, they're animals.
Right. And the real shame about this is that Huckabee had almost a point when he was talking about this. I mean, he made the observation that a lot of large-scale protests and demonstrations that can turn violent often happen on Fridays, the Muslim day of prayer. But what he doesn't seem to realize or acknowledge is the context of why that's the case. Because, I mean, their Friday is their Sunday, basically, so most people have the day off. They're all out of the house, outside on the streets in convenient places, the mosques. And so when they leave there, it's much easier to rally and organize people to do things like protest in favor of democracy or against military rule or against extremism, which is what we saw in Egypt during the last upheaval. And so for Huckabee to just take something like protest on Friday and then immediately go to, this must mean that Muslims are dangerous or they treat their days of prayer ill, that shows a lack of understanding and insight on his part.
Well, and I would add, I'm old enough to remember in the 1960s when this very same kind of language was used to describe people who were participating in civil rights marches and you know, outspokenly in civil rights activity coming out of the black churches.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like this, it just seems to me that this is that the underbelly of racism in this society has never gone away. It hasn't diminished. We haven't, you know, everybody says everything's all well now. Everything, not so much, I don't think. Your thoughts on that?
Right. I mean, the phrase has been tossed around that we live in a post-racial society, and that's right. Not entirely true. During his press conference today, when riffing on the fact that the immigration bill passed in the Senate wouldn't solve 100% of the problem, President Obama said that, "I don't know a single law that solves 100% of a problem." One of the examples he gave was that the Voting Rights Act helped lessen discrimination, but discrimination still exists, which is a really good, true observation to make. I mean, discrimination most definitely does still exist. There have been laws put into place to help it out. Society as a whole, I feel, is much better about dealing with issues of race, but there are still these pockets and these institutional situations where discrimination still exists and thrives even.
So what do we do about this?
That's a great question. I mean, what the best thing we can do is raise our voices when we see these instances happen and don't let them just slide by, I suppose. I mean, if we all just turned a blind eye towards when someone refers to an entire group as uncolored animals or makes derogatory statements in general, then it's much easier for that sort of thing to propagate, to be seen as just, oh, it's a normal thing. But if we continue to speak out against it, that's, I think, the best way to really change the way things are looked at.
Yeah, speaking out. And your thoughts on the idea of reaching across, reaching out. We had this discussion really rather aggressively in the 60s and 70s that led to things like busing and led to things like the Voting Rights Act and led to things like civil rights acts and laws and it seemed for a while there that we were really making some progress and really changing things. And now we're seeing state after state that's putting into place voter suppression ID laws that largely target people of color. We're hearing this kind of rhetoric from people like Reverend Huckabee, who is on a national radio network. If a liberal were to say something like that, I mean, Ed Schultz called a woman a bad word once, and he was, 2 weeks he was off the air. I don't think that would happen on right-wing radio.
No, I think that you're right, but also because you have to look at who the clientele is. I mean, if no one in Huckabee's audience is complaining, then what reason would the radio stations have to pull him?
Right.
I mean, so you do need to do some of that outreach that you mentioned, but you also have to take into account that most of his base doesn't really see a problem with his comments, and most of the people that are convinced of the arguments for more voter ID laws and things of that nature, they will believe that what they're doing is more about voting and not about race.
Yeah, I think, contrary to what our Supreme Court has recently said, that we really still need to be aggressively working in these areas legislatively. Hayes Brown, national security blogger and reporter over at thinkprogress.org. Thank you, Hayes.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Think Progress is just an absolutely great blog. I encourage you to check it out. Thinkprogress.org. Hayes does some brilliant writing there. Past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. Welcome back. And David in Denver, Colorado. Hey, David, thanks for listening to AM 760 there in Denver. What's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. With your last guest, the topic of Islam came up. And I think it's a topic that we all are going to have to approach from a different standpoint. To just knee-jerk say that people are being bigoted against Muslims, that's really not dealing with the issue head on.
Mm-hmm.
We need to look at history and at the actual doctrines of Islam. And the fact is, Islam is intolerant. And Islam
so
really.
If you're going to use that kind of broad brush, the same is true of Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism.
I think actually our democracy evolved out of Christianity. But let me just focus on Islam for a minute. We are really kidding ourselves if we think we're going to be able to integrate it into the West and retain our freedoms as we
happen. David, that's nonsense. I have several good friends who are Muslims, and they are fully integrated into the West, and they're very peaceful and rational people. Well, there are parts. Islam is, in my opinion, right now, Islam is going through, as a whole, the billion-plus Muslims in the world are going through a Reformation time that is not all that different from the Reformation that Christianity went through with Martin Luther and with King Henry VIII. And I think that as they go through this, they will become more, less fundamentalist, let's say.
Tom.
I'm sorry?
Let me tell people that the Quran, a man named Bill Warner has gone through the Quran and using statistics, verse by verse, it has more anti-Semitic hate speech in it than Mein Kampf. It's a statistical fact.
David, this is nonsense. Yeah, I could easily read to you verses out of what I'm assuming is your Bible, where God is telling people like Joshua to go out and kill every person, every living thing, everybody who's not Jewish. Cut open the bellies of the pregnant women, kill the animals, put the king's head on a stake out in front of the city. Does that mean that we should worry about Jews or, for that matter, Christians who use the same Bible? No.
Here's the thing, Tom. In the Old Testament, when the Israelites were told to do that, it was for that specific time and that specific tribe. If you look at it in comparison,
David,
to the Quran.
No, David, you don't know what you're talking about. I believe that your intentions are well, but you are just tragically misinformed. Jason, in Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I was just going to comment specifically about the Obama administration. When it comes to anything with this NSA stuff, they have zero credibility. You know, I go back to the 10-year anniversary of 9/11 when the ACLU came out and determined that Obama's been worse on civil liberties than Bush was, and Bush was horrible. I think this is just a smoke and mirror type of thing by the administration to try to backpedal and make it seem like they're actually doing something, with knowing full well that nothing will be rolled back. And what the administration and the previous administration have done is that they have taken the position of it's better to apologize than to ask for permission for what they're doing.
Yes.
This FISA court stuff is completely another big scam. You know, what are you going to do? You're going to put somebody in there who's going to, you know, why don't we put Justice Roberts to defend the people that are being accused of these warrantless wiretaps? You know, if I get to pick who the person is who's defending me, that might be, you might be better off just having nobody defend me in this particular case. But
Jason, I understand your cynicism, and to a certain extent I share it, in as much as I think that what the president is proposing is the absolute minimum that he feels he must do in order to recover the confidence of the majority of the public. And there are going to be, and there are a lot of us, both on the libertarian left, not libertarian, the civil libertarian left, and the civil libertarian right, who will not be satisfied by this. But it's better than nothing, and I don't mean that, you know, to tip my hat to him. I mean, it's a start. But I strongly feel that we need to be pushing Congress on this, that we need another one of those votes like the one to defund the NSA that came within 7 votes of winning in the House of Representatives, much to the shock of everybody from Nancy Pelosi to John Boehner. We need this to be pursued in the Senate the way that Ron Wyden and Pat Leahy and others are talking about. And that's only going to happen if enough of us speak out. So rather than just, you know, trashing the messenger or the message for that matter, I think that what we need to do is get organized, and we need to be contacting our members of Congress, and we need to be showing up, you know, and with organizations who are working on these kinds of things. RootsAction.org has got some good action steps, you know, around Ed Snowden, for example, over at their website. But we need to show up. Jason, thank you for the call. Clifford in Ishpeming, Michigan. Hey, Clifford, what's up?
Yeah, well, you know, listening to the news again, and we got
that can be dangerous, Clifford.
Pardon?
That can be dangerous. I'm joking. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I mean, about the states doing the things about the voting. And, you know, I wonder why. You know, I've tried to pay attention to politics all along, and I'm really beginning to wonder, you know, whose side and what's on. You know, why the Republicans have voted 39 times to defund Obamacare. I have
40 times now. They just held their 40th.
How many?
40.
40.
40th vote was last week.
So, you know, where are the progressives when it comes to stopping this. I have never seen.
Well, the progressives have stopped it. That's why these bills, you know, that's why these bills are sort of the legislative equivalent of masturbation. I mean, there's nothing that's going to come as a consequence of this. There's not, you know, it ain't making a baby, right? They're not making legislation. It is the Democrats in the Senate are stopping these things, and the progressives in the House, of course, are not going along with it. So, if your question is why aren't progressives trying to have 40 votes on single-payer health care, the answer is really simple. They don't control the House of Representatives.
The thing of it is that you see nothing. Even and even again with all the fraud that's going on, you know, it's sick. Because, you know, if you do a fraud, a little fraud, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000, you're going to jail.
Yeah. No, there's the whole rationale for voter suppression. You're right, Clifford. Is nonsense. It's all about suppressing the votes of minorities. You're absolutely right.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
28 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, back with more of your calls and my thoughts right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and thanks so much. Oh, that's for the next half hour, isn't it? Okay. Sorry, I'm not used to seeing things in the prompter. Let's get back to the phone calls here. It is the bottom of the hour, and Tony in Henderson, North Carolina. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing?
I'm fine. How are you today?
All right. You know, as a Democrat, I believe, I know what Republicans want to do. Ever since Monday, they want to set the government down. They want to get rid of Obamacare. But I'd like to know what the Democratic Party going to do. You know, when they go on vacation, where they contract on job. Now, I want to see my Democratic leaders out there on the front capitol with a big sign that contract on job and you get up at the house.
Tony, where the Democrats are going is they're going back to their districts to hold town hall meetings and find out what people want and spread the word and basically also campaign for reelection. I don't disagree with you that now would be a wonderful time for them to be, you know, doing some good street theater here in Washington, D.C., although I don't know how much news coverage it would get. But, yeah, the Democrats do need to be making more noise. They do make a fair amount of noise, and they do it fairly frequently. They hold a lot of press conferences. And the thing is, the corporate media, which is mostly right-leaning because it is corporate media, doesn't pay attention to it. So they're out there trying, trust me, the progressives, the Democrats are trying, but they just don't get the attention that they should. Thanks for the call, Tony. Well said. Linda in Chicago. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to tell you how proud I am of our governor in Illinois, Pat Quinn, because he has stopped the pay of people in Congress, and also given up his paycheck until they pass the pension reform for the state of Illinois. I'm so proud of him, and I'm going to vote for him again because he has the guts.
Yeah, does their pension reform have to do with making sure that the pensions are fully funded? Is that the deal in Illinois?
I believe so. I can't say it clearly right now.
Yeah.
But I know it.
Okay.
I was hoping you could explain it a little bit better than me.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't live in Illinois, and I haven't been following the details of that. But I do know that pension funds all over the United States are in trouble, and the main reason is that, you know, for the last couple of decades, well, actually, for the last 32 years, growth has not been going as fast as it did before Reagan. You know, Reaganomics has hollowed out pensions as well. And the formula that they used to use up until the Reagan era to calculate pensions going forward assumed a 7% growth in annual fund value. And between the fact that funds have not been growing at that rate, plus the theft of trillions, with a T, trillions of dollars from America by the banksters with a bubble that burst in 2008, which took down every pension fund in America, I mean, decreased its value, as well as everyone's 401k and everything else, they're underfunded. And so if the governor is trying to do something about that in a way that doesn't take out a bite out of the behinds of, you know, working people in Illinois, I applaud that. But I don't know the details of it, Linda, so I'm sorry. I have to kind of pass on that. But thanks for the call. Nelson in Remmer, Tennessee. Hey, Nelson, what's up?
Hello, Tom. I'm glad I got through.
Hello, Nelson. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Read an article on Reuters online, and I'm kind of shocked. Congress and, the House and Senate, I didn't know it, but they were unintentionally forced into Obamacare. And they are getting about 75% of provision to pay for their portion.
Yeah, here's what happened. When Obamacare was passed, first of all, one of the missions of Obamacare, as defined by the president when he was pitching Obamacare back in the day, was let's make sure that every American has the same health care that every American or every member of Congress has. Members of Congress have an exchange in which they can select from which health insurance company they're going to buy insurance. Now, the government pays for the insurance, but they can pick which insurance they get, and they can choose to pay extra for certain plans and all this kind of thing. And so President Obama said, let's just do this with everybody. And if you have an employer and your employer picks up the tab, you know, you can pick, or the employer can pick. And if you're on your own, you can pick. The problem with it was that the employees of members of Congress who are federal employees, because Congress has its own special little scheme, which isn't part of all the other federal employees in the United States. One of the right wingers, when Obamacare was passed, said, "Well, you know, let's take the employees of Congress." This is my understanding of how this went about. Let's take the employees of Congress out of the federal program and put them in Obamacare. But nobody ever did that. So those federal employees, when Obamacare goes into effect, end up with basically no health care at all. And excuse me, my arm is nodding up here. And the consequence of that is that they were freaked out. I'm talking about the congressional aides and things like that. And so Congress just very quickly passed a little piece of legislation that both sides agreed on that allowed the employees of Congress to buy insurance under Obamacare. So it's kind of not a big deal, although the right wing was trying to make it a big deal for a while. I'm not sure exactly what mileage they thought they'd get out of it. But am I making sense here, Nelson?
They've been screaming about it for months.
Yeah. Yeah. They definitely have been doing that. They definitely have been doing that. Nelson, thanks a lot for the call. Brad in Chicago. Hey, Brad, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Love the show. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the, you know, back to the Edward Snowden NSA thing. I'm kind of, you know, like I said, I am a liberal, and I'm kind of surprised that a lot of the backlash that a lot of people on the, what I heard you call the civil libertarian left, kind of coming together with the libertarian right shocks me, because, you know, the NSA is a legal agency, and to this point, nothing that they have been doing has been found to be illegal or unconstitutional.
That's because it's never been litigated.
Well, definitely, and I don't think it can be because of Smith versus Maryland in 78 or 79. It talks about reasonable expectation of privacy.
No, it could be litigated. It's just that it would have to be litigated in federal court. And the ACLU actually has lawsuits, as does the Electronic Freedom Frontier Foundation, and EPIC also. The electronic privacy something, I forget what EPIC stands for, but there are a number of good organizations that do have federal lawsuits against the NSA right this minute as we speak, and I believe the Center for Constitutional Rights has one as well, and those things eventually, some of them might even end up before the Supreme Court, and boy, would it be nice if there was something other than a 5-vote right-wing majority on the Supreme Court. But Smith versus Maryland does not invalidate these cases, Brad. It absolutely doesn't. It didn't invalidate the Fourth Amendment. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yes, I want to make a couple of points, if I might. One with regard to the discussion of Islam and the way in which some people want to characterize it as being somehow disproportionately adherent to violence or advocating violence.
Right.
I would argue that given the scholarship that we recognize that the history of religion in any given society undergoes evolution. That's why though one might characterize Western Europe as being a Christian land, mm-hmm. it's far less likely that people there find their lives governed, a political agenda, let alone a violent agenda that stems from that, because they've undergone an evolution. It's less so in the United States. You're more likely to find an Eric Rudolph here than you are in, say, Western Europe,
yeah,
where the discussion of abortion doesn't even take place. And the notion that anyone would take the stage in a presidential debate in Western Europe and talk about Jesus or God as being important in terms of public policy,
it would be shocking.
Yes, exactly. And so we do need to recognize that for Islam, I think that they are undergoing an evolutionary period.
Yeah, that was my point. I said that I think Islam is going through a reformation. Islam is only 700 years old. Christianity is 2,000 years old. Judaism is 3,000 years old. Buddhism and Hinduism are somewhere between 3,000 and 7,000 years old. You know, all of these religions, with the exception of Islam, have, you know, Islam is relatively recent. Mormonism is going through a reformation right now, too. There was an interesting piece in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about this.
And you're absolutely correct. And we do have to recognize, to be intellectually honest and say, you know, that given the nature of where this religion stands in terms of the societies where it's practiced,
mm-hmm,
one can say it is more likely that you are going to find a Muslim suicide bomber than you are, as a colleague of mine put it, than you're going to find a Buddhist suicide bomber. Have you ever heard of a Buddhist suicide bomber?
Well, I don't know of any nation that's ever been invaded in the name of Buddha. I mean, Buddhism is the one world religion that explicitly started out and has always been a religion of peace. And I don't mean that in the kind of generic, you know, friendly...
Right, absolutely, and I would agree with you. Interpreters of religion such that they believe that it falls upon them to extend their faith through violence is obviously a problem. So, again, I think that the call, I certainly agree with you with regard to the way in which we need to look more deeply and deconstruct this question, not simply, you know, the sort of blanket statement that, you know, Islam is full of a bunch of crazy people who want to go out and kill everyone else in the name of Islam. Instead, it requires a much deeper sense of analysis. And also, I wanted to say that in terms of this question of race and where we've come in our society, I don't want to be too cynical, because I was listening to the discussion you were having, and it certainly is the case that we have a long way to go.
Yeah.
But we've also come a long way.
You're right. And we need to acknowledge that. And perhaps I wasn't sufficiently in my conversation with Hayes Brown. Steve, thank you for the call. Well said. It is 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. I got to tell you about a couple other of the things over at rootsaction.org. They've got a really great list of things you can participate
You're
in.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
And my point about the importance of single-issue politics, I'm really starting to get my head around this. I want to share that with you after we get back. Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the folks at all the organizations that syndicate this program, Dow Global on the commercial side, Pacifica Radio on the non-commercial side, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, CRN Network on cable radio systems around the country, Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country. Thank you to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on our show, The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones, and all the folks at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jake Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, or the stations that carry our show, to our sponsors and our underwriters, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you so very, very much. You keep us going. You really, really, truly do. Dee in Bellingham, Washington, listening on KBAI. Hey, Dee, what's up?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and I've been listening to you for quite a while. I've never called before, so kind of nervous. I just wanted to suggest that people pick up a copy of Irving Wallace's novel, The Man. I don't know if you remember, but it came out in 1964.
Yeah.
And it was very controversial then. Mm-hmm. And it provides some very interesting insights into what President Obama is going through.
Tell me how.
Well, he's facing a lot of hypocrisy, a lot of
people who don't want him there, people who are trying to patronize him as president. There's a black, the story's about a black man who through a series of accidents and succession ends up being the president of the United States.
Back in 1964.
In 1964.
Wow.
And the way the people of the United States respond to him has some direct parallels to the way people are treating Obama. It was really an amazing, it's really an amazing novel. I haven't read it all the way through yet, but he faces all the same antagonism, the same hypocrisy, the same hatred.
Remarkable. I'll keep an eye out for
Obama.
It, Dee. Thank you for that. It sounds like good summer reading, even though it's from 64. Irving Wallace's book, The Man. Thanks for the heads up. Yeah, thanks for the heads up. Thank you. I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Merlene in Morriston, Florida. Hey, Merlene, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm such a pleasure to talk to you. And I wanted to tell you, you've got color in your face. You must have had some sun last weekend.
Yeah, we did. We got out and walked around a lot. It was nice.
Yeah, well, it really showed, it looked like you were energized.
Good.
What I wanted to ask you about was Alex. I consider them a subversive group or organization.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why our Justice Department couldn't go after them. Of course, we don't have a real good Attorney General.
Well, no, it's not. This is not the problem. This is not a problem with the Attorney General's office. The problem is with the Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court has decriminalized what Alec is doing and made it perfectly legal for billionaires and transnational corporations to buy state legislators, to bribe state legislators, to wine and dine state legislators, and to even write laws for them. I mean, you would think that if there should be a law against anything, it would be a corporation actually writing a law that regulates the affairs and behaviors of that corporation. But no, not only is there no such law. Pardon? I'm sorry, I missed what you're saying.
I said that's why it's so subversive.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree, but I would say that the real subversives are the nine men and women sitting on the Supreme Court just a couple blocks from where I sit right now, because they made it possible. And that's what we need to change. We need to say that corporations are not people, money is not speech, and you can jump on that bandwagon over at movetoamend.org. Merlene, thank you for the call. I think you're right. Emma in Beach Park, Illinois. Hey, Emma, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to respond to the caller about the Illinois pension crisis and Governor Quinn's role in that.
Okay, you know something about it?
Yeah, I'm a retired teacher, so I'm one of the people who's affected. And I'm pretty active in, state-level things, not in office, but just an activist citizen.
Mm-hmm.
Governor Quinn is a good guy. He's done a lot of really good things, but that's not his intent here. To solve the pension for us retirees. We've paid in from payroll. We do not get Social Security, so we don't get an employer match. We basically have to pay our own pensions through our careers.
Right.
The state does contribute also.
Right.
However, for many years, the state chose not to make its contributions that are required by statute. As a result, the fund was underfunded. Additionally, there was corruption. You may recall Governor Quinn acceded to office when the disgraced Governor Blagojevich was impeached.
Right.
One of the things that Governor Blagojevich had done was he appointed some cronies to the board of trustees of the various public pension funds, of which there are several.
Mm.
Some of them have been indicted. Some of them are in jail. So the money was frittered away. The money was never deposited as required. Organizations sued to force the state to pay in what was required, and we were told we could not sue the state. And so now the system is completely underfunded and starting to show some actuarial unsoundness.
Mm.
Thus the rise now in the demand to kind of
to do something.
Scott Walker, mean-spirited, but that kind of thing to blame the victim.
Oh my, Emma, I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm pleased to know what the details and the facts are, and thank you for a thoughtful and detailed analysis. But it's like this, as I said earlier, this is happening all over the country, not just in Illinois. Thank you, Emma. Coming up Monday on the Tom Hartman Program, all the latest news and information from the weekend. Plus, regulations protect us from many harmful things, including pesticides. There are some on the right who would like to see us go back to the days when pesticides were totally unregulated. This is going to be a rumble you don't want to miss. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.